Welcome to the podcast service of the Massachusetts Climate Action Network. Visit us online at massclimateaction.net or friend us on Facebook.
Hi. And welcome to this edition of A Climate Hawk's Companion, a podcast that gives thoughtful people some information and background to help them better understand the big issues related to global warming. Now, as climate hawks, we often speak of mitigation. We use the word mitigation basically to talk about reducing new additions of carbon dioxide, new emissions into the atmosphere, right? Energy efficiency, renewable energies, all that kind of stuff, reduces the amount of carbon dioxide that we're currently adding. Of course, there's always this idea lurking in the background of, wouldn't it be nice to remove carbon dioxide from the atmosphere that was put up 100 years ago, right? That'd be great. Anyway, such things of removing, idea of removing carbon dioxide from the atmosphere leads to really crazy proposals that are not worth really discussing. But today we're going to talk to a gentleman who has an idea of using natural processes to basically sequester carbon dioxide into the soil and in the process help improve our farming and feed the world. So it's worth a listen, and let's do exactly that. Hi, everybody. So we're here with Carl Tiedemann, and it just so happens I ran into him at the Massachusetts Climate Action Network's annual conference. Now, Carl's an interesting guy because he has been working to promote the following idea, that it is possible through farming techniques, on the farm, down home on the farm, the way that you grow your food actually can capture carbon out of the air very effectively, improving the soil quality, at the same time sequestering, taking out of the air enough carbon to make a difference. And I thought it would be interesting to take a moment to hear from him the actual story. So, Carl, did I get it right? I mean, is it more or less the right? Tell me what the story is.
Exactly, Ted. I've been a climate activist for about 20 years, and during most of that time thought that there was nothing much that could be done about the carbon that was accumulating in the atmosphere. I think everyone pretty much understands that we have to cut emissions, and we have to cut them as rapidly as we possibly can, and nothing that I say should suggest anything other than that. But what many are beginning to understand is, with the legacy burden of carbon in the atmosphere, the heating will continue for centuries, if not longer, if we don't do something about the amount that's accumulated.
Already,
that's correct. Even if we stop burning all fossil fuels today. This is a point that the IPCC has made in some of their declarations. And so the question has been, how do we get it out of the air? Fortunately, we can look toward nature as an example. Nature has been removing carbon throughout the eons. The way nature does it is through photosynthesis. As plants grow, they take carbon out of the air, and then they exude sugars through their roots that go into the soil.
And so photosynthesis is what everyone learned as a sophomore in high school, right? This mechanism of taking carbon dioxide in, putting out oxygen is what I remember. But you're saying that additionally, the sugars get driven down into the soil.
In some cases, half of the photosynthetic potential of the plant or more is transferred and released as energy, essentially solar energy in the form of sugar going into the soil. And people would say, why would a plant give up half of its energy like that? And the reason is to feed the underground soil life, the bacteria and the fungal networks, which result in a much stronger, healthier plant.
Ultimately, the plant is taking care of its own soil. By
exactly.
Feeding the bugs in the soil to make the soil richer. Wow, interesting concept.
It's a great synergetic process, or synergistic process, that, as I said, evolved over time. Mm-hmm. And most recently, this issue has come into the highlight. On December 1st, France's Minister of Agriculture, a fellow named Stéphane Le Foll, announced what they call their 4 per 1,000 global soil initiative.
This is in Paris, France, last December.
During right? the climate talks.
During the climate, the big Paris Agreement party. Okay?
Exactly. It was a parallel effort that was going on. The name 4 per 1,000 comes from their calculation that if farmers and ranchers throughout the world increased the carbon content of their soil by 4 parts in 1,000 each year, that would offset the growing carbon dioxide in the atmosphere to the point that the CO2 curve would stop rising. It would essentially level out. Many of us believe that we can then take it further and begin to lower the CO2 level, but that would have to be commensurate with activities such as cutting carbon emissions.
But I mean, it's almost like a geoengineering proposal. You're saying that if we rejuvenated, let me just say it in the most crude way, if you rejuvenate the dirt, it sucks carbon out of the air, the dirt's better, the food's better, and the air is actually, you're taking out some of that accumulated CO2 from the air, and you're actually driving the parts per million in the air down.
That's correct. Instead of geoengineering, which is essentially applying additional forces to the ecosystem, mm-hmm. there's a new term, well, not so new at this point, it's quite a few decades old, called geotherapy. Essentially, it's a way of healing the earth.
Yeah, I like that one even better, geotherapy, okay.
And so far, 26 countries, including the United Kingdom, Australia, and Japan, some heavy hitters have joined this proposal. So far, the U.S. and Canada have not yet. And it's for that reason that this past Wednesday at the National Press Club in Washington, D.C., a representative of France's Ministry of Agriculture mm-hmm. came and delivered a proposal to a packed room. The audience members included quite a few people from various scientific organizations here in the U.S. Several of the top soil scientists and range scientists were also there giving presentations as well. And the hope is that if we can promote this program here in the U.S., perhaps the U.S. would become a signatory as well.
Well, just before, I mean, let me understand. The program, I mean, what is the farmer, let me take my own example. I'm going to grow tomatoes this summer. Okay. I want to follow the principles of this. What does it mean? I mean, in practice.
There are quite a few different things that farmers can do, and some have been done for decades. Others are starting to be done more often now. Something as simple, for example, as no-till, which means not plowing anymore. Mm-hmm. Most people associate plowing with farming as like bread and butter.
It's a picture of Abraham, you know, behind the bull plowing across the Euphrates or something, right?
Precisely.
They say, don't do that anymore.
As it turns out, starting with the organic community back many decades ago, but now even many conventional farmers have stopped plowing altogether. And how does it work in practice? Well, what they'll do now is they use seed drills to put the seeds or the plugs exactly where they want. And then at the end of the season, after they get their harvest, they use crimping machines that bend the stalks over to form sort of a bed of compost left on the soil. This is important for several reasons. It's crucial to keep ground covered. Anytime you have bare ground, if you see a field that's been freshly plowed, you can look at it the same way you would a smokestack or a tailpipe. The carbon dioxide, it's invisible, but it's coming out of it just uh-huh. as surely. Uh-huh. And that happens because the ultraviolet rays of the sun will bake any organic molecules on the surface. That's why it's important to keep the soil covered at all times.
Just, forgive me for repeating, I mean, you said it clearly, but you see a plowed field, the UV from the sun is basically destroying the goodness in the soil, drying it out by breaking things up.
That's right.
Wow.
And over time, what will happen is that rich black soil that you know by mm-hmm. its smell and by the sticky feel of mm-hmm. it, eventually it degrades until it looks like sand. Uh-huh. And that's a process uh-huh. called desertification. Uh-huh. And that means that it's lost its soil carbon. I first learned of this in a talk that Al Gore had given. And he said as a young boy, his father had taken him to a patch on their tobacco farm that had never been plowed and never been tilled. And the soil there was the richest in their entire property. And that's when Al Gore began to understand how important carbon mm-hmm. was in soil. Mm-hmm. Most are surprised to learn, as was I, that Estimates are approximately twice as much carbon has gone into the atmosphere from land erosion and soil degradation mm-hmm. than from the burning of all fossil fuels. Now, this is a process that began some 8,000 years ago mm-hmm. At the dawn of agriculture. William Ruddiman had a terrific story in Scientific American asking when did anthropogenic climate change begin, and he says it was 8,000 years ago. Uh-huh. And what's startling is if you look at the Vostok ice core data, then you can see very clearly that the temperature, which peaked...
So the Vostok is this sort of famous chart most climate hawks have seen of the carbon dioxide over the last 100,000 years, right? And it starts to rise, well, certainly dramatically in the last couple hundred years, but you're saying you go back 8,000 years?
Well, if you go back and look at, there are even longer ice core records now, some going back 400,000, as far mm-hmm. back as 800,000 years ago. And associated with the carbon dioxide increases and decreases, you can see the temperature rising and falling pretty much in lockstep. The temperature data comes in part from the study of foraminifera, which is a type of micro plankton that lives in the ocean.
There are little shells.
1,000 species.
Yeah.
Each has a very specific temperature preference, so by looking in the fossil record, we can get a pretty good sense of what the temperatures in the oceans were.
Right.
Well, we come to find out that following the end of each of the ice ages, when the CO2 would peak and the temperature would peak, the temperature would fall off dramatically. It would just come to a sharp point and just fall off. But 10,000 years ago, or about 8,000 years ago, something different happened that was unprecedented. The temperature leveled out. And so what Ruddiman says is that humans, by disturbing the land for the plowing and for the burning of forest and the need for wood to fuel the Iron Age and for the battering rams and all the other weapons of war,
the, ships. The Trojan horse and the...
In fact, as a side note, there's a great book, Trees and Timber in the Ancient Mediterranean World, that was written by an Oxford scholar, and he attempts to quantify how much wood was taken down and removed.
But that's fascinating, because, I mean, I've always heard this story that this last ice age has been unique because of the stability of the post-ice age temperature at just the sort of Goldilocks. And what you're saying is that it could conceivably be because we were plowing the earth and allowing enough CO. Wow.
Humans inadvertently created the stable, the Holocene, this abnormally warm, extendedly... You know,
in which they could live and flourish.
In which all of human civilization flourished.
And now by getting rid of the fossil fuels, they've sort of done themselves... Well, this is fascinating. So let me put a few things together. You said 4 parts per thousand. I'm trying to do my arithmetic here. That's 0.04% per year. 0.04%.
That's correct.
Right? A tiny, but at the same time, it's global, right?
That's correct. So
now you have to in the near future, you're not going to get the whole globe to follow these, let's just say, no-till practices, right?
That's one example. There are others. The use of cover crops, for example, the use of compost as
a rotation of crops. I guess the question is, there's a very specific set of farming practices that are not crazy. How do they get rolled out? I mean, if some guy in South Sudan, presumably you're going to start in the United States, whether you have the money and the technology and the communication to convince farmers. And what's the argument? Sorry, now a bunch of questions, but what's the argument that says, oh yeah, if you do this, we're all going to starve because the yield isn't as high? I'm sure you've thought about that.
Sure. It can take several years to transition, and some of the practices are, they don't need to be expensive. For example, the use of cover crops, mm-hmm. for example. In the case of planned grazing, there's a certain amount of area in the world that's used for growing crops, and then there's a certain amount used for grazing. The grazing land is far greater than that used for growing crops. So over grazing lands, what can be done is simply by modifying how the animals are grazed. Typically, what you see is in a conventional grazing system is that every animal has access to every plant all season long. As a consequence, no animal or no plant ever has a chance to grow to maturity. If you go drive past a farm in New England, you might see a dozen cows out in a pasture nibbling, each in their own corner, and you think how natural. It's not. If you put one wolf or a dog into that paddock, immediately the animals will bunch together into a herd. In the same way that fish school together and birds mm-hmm. flock together, whenever you find a predator-prey relationship in nature, very often bunching or herding is part of it. What difference does that make? Well, what we find is that if animals are herded together and if they're moved as a bunch, and never allowed to come back and regraze the same spot until 4 months, 5 months goes by. Then the grasses in that area have a chance to grow, fertilized by the manure, by the nitrogen in the urine, even the bacteria in the saliva and in the manure are shown to be important for inoculating the soil bacteria. So that's something that does not involve any cost. Typically, this is happening on places where the animals are already grazing, but just they're not being grazed properly. Mm-hmm. Now, there are institutional barriers to overcome. In many parts of the world, typically a family owns one head of cattle, and they invest their entire lives. It's kind of like their savings, right. Life savings.
This is a heifer project where you give a family a cow and then they're better off kind of thing, right?
Exactly. And I'll mention in passing that the Heifer International is now working with the Savory Institute. Okay. And Alan Savory was the wildlife biologist in Zimbabwe who figured out how to do so-called regenerative grazing some 40 years ago. So there's this barrier because families are concerned like, well, you know, if my animal is bunched now together with all the others, what if my animal gets sick and so forth? So there's that psychological barrier to overcome. But in places where it has been implemented, suddenly the family realizes, gosh, I don't have to be with my animal all day long. Like maybe I can start a school or start a bakery or take care of my mother or, you know, do all these other, you know, pressing concerns. And so it's a way of actually stimulating economic development in the communities, as well as improving the fertility of land, improving the nutrition of the food, restoring wildlife habitat, and so on.
It's clearly there's a lot of depth and potential in, you know, different techniques. But the rock bottom line here is the argument or the observation, or the scientific fact that by properly managing the soil of either farmlands or grazing lands, it's possible to aggressively recapture carbon dioxide out of the air in a way that is, as you say, geotherapy, right? It's a natural process that benefits the planet, and that I can see how reasonable people would jump up and down and tear their hair out that we're not all much more focused on such an idea because it seems so beautiful and elegant, right? And so you've been I mean, as we were speaking, all I can think of is, you know, when I was a young man, there was a rock and roll group called Jethro Tull, right? And, of course, I learned many years later that Jethro Tull invented a cedar, right, that would plant...
A cedro, right? That's exactly,
and, yep. And it changed agriculture, right? So, and this was like 17...
Right around 1800.
1800, okay, yep. Right. But I mean, so now what you're proposing is sort of a second Jethro Tull, right, where now we have this new technology and it revolutionizes farming for the benefit of everyone. Fascinating, right?
That's correct. And the biological community, there have been papers published supporting this concept going back to the 1980s. Just last week, Chemical and Engineering News, which is a flagship publication of the American Chemical Society, had a cover story dedicated to soil carbon drawdown as a climate mitigation strategy. So great to see the chemists on board. There are physicists I've spoken to who have reservations about the residence time of the carbon in the soil, but there's been a lot of great research coming out, as well as examples from nature. The soil in the Great Plains have been building up for 10,000 years. Yeah. The carbon has been accumulating in the soil. So I think that there's evidence that it can work. The land will need to be managed properly in the future.
No matter what.
If we disrupt it again, just as surely the carbon can come out as it has, you know, by doing things wrong. But my organization, which is called Soil for Climate, that's the number four.
Soil, S-O-I-L, number four, Climate. Soil for Climate, okay?
That's right. Our Facebook group, which started back in July, now has about 1,600 members, including scientists, farmers, ranchers, journalists, policymakers, and concerned citizens from around the world, ranging from Senegal to Scandinavia to Latin America, people who identify with this concept and are trying to promote it within their own communities to the extent
and
possible.
That's what you would ask people to do, is to know about it, understand that it exists, and basically talk about it, because you may not have a herd of cattle in your backyard, but it certainly is a topic that ought to be propagated and discussed.
Even the ways we keep our lawns, what surprises people even is that the use of petrochemical-based fertilizers and, of course, pesticides disrupts the soil life to the extent that carbon sequestration by nature is limited or in some cases stops completely.
Really?
In the case of essentially dead soil, which I'm sorry to say, much of the farming that takes place in the Midwest is almost an aquaculture. I mean, yes, they're plants growing in dirt, but it's the chemicals that are propping them up.
Right.
And nature worked wonderfully for millions of years with thriving soil, sunshine and water as the only ingredients that were necessary for fecundity and for abundant crops year after year after year. And while it's true that if you're growing on dead soil, you need the chemical fertilizers, otherwise ain't nothing going to grow. But what we're discovering is even highly degraded land can be brought back into fertility, you know, over a period of a number of years, you know, in most cases less than a decade. You see a very rapid turnaround, and there are just more and more examples to be seen. And that's why I applaud Francis. It's a first state-sponsored initiative to promote this, and thrilled to be getting behind it.
Well, it's fascinating to talk about. Thank you so much for taking the time to chat. It's really interesting, and I'm sure that we will discuss this again. So thank you very much for being here.
My pleasure, Ted. Thank you very much.
Thanks for listening to the Climate Hawks Companion.